Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's June 27, 2012, and this is episode 341. Last week, on June 20, I was one of the lucky few in Japan to receive a phone call to let me know that my Canon EOS 1DX digital SLR camera was ready to pick up on the day of its launch. Having spent a lot of time with the camera over the last 6 days, today we're going to review this amazing new flagship from Canon. I should say straight up that because I'm not a sports shooter, you aren't going to see test shots of athletes running towards me, as is often the case with reviews of the 1D series from Canon. I was able to do some bird photography though, which is another common use of these fast frame cameras. So we'll touch on the results of a couple of bird shoots, as well as some high ISO performance test, which is another area that I know people are anxious to hear about. First though, let's take a look at the camera itself and touch on some of the nice new features. As we progress, I'll compare the 1DX with the 5D Mark III, which I own and reviewed in March, and have been using a lot over the last 3 months. I'll also compare the 1DX to its predecessor, the 1D Mark IV sometimes, when it seems more relevant. I sold my 1D Mark IV in part exchange for the 1DX, so I'm not able to shoot any comparison shots or show the cameras side by side, etc. Note too that there are almost 40 images in the blog post for this week's podcast, so I'm not going to embed all of these into the Enhanced podcast. I'll put in some shots of the 1DX and a few of the other shots, but the ISO test shots will only be available on the blog, and that will enable you to see more detail too. So please head over to the blog at mbp.ac/341 to view the test shots. The first thing that I noticed when I took the 1DX out of the box was how sleek it is. The black paint seems coarser in a good way than the 1D Mark IV, which was a little smoother and shinier. The lines either side of the pentaprism chamber are rounder, and the camera overall just looks and feels more refined. It's a brick, of course, in a good way, and weighs just over 1.5 kilograms, so if weight is a consideration, this is not the camera for you. If you ever held a 1D Mark IV, the 1DX is actually about 160 grams heavier. I personally like the weight of these 1 series cameras. I buy them for their ruggedness and really just expect them to be on the hefty side. Externally, there are also a number of new buttons. On the front of the camera, we now have 2 depth of field preview buttons, so you can use either depending on whether you're holding the camera in landscape or portrait mode. Also, right next to the depth of field preview buttons are new multifunction buttons. There is also a multifunction button close to the main dial behind the shutter buttons. So the new multifunction buttons on the front of the camera are called multifunction 2 buttons. The 2 multifunction 2 buttons can be configured to do a number of things, and you'll of course need to make your own selection, you know, what works for you. But for me at the moment, I've configured mine to toggle between one shot and AI servo focus modes. The super telephoto lenses from Canon have buttons around the front that I always program to do this, so it's nice now to be able to toggle easily with all of my lenses and not just my super telephotos. So I've found that very useful so far. On the back of the camera, there is a new quick control button. This is also on the 5D Mark III, but it was not on the 1D Mark IV. If you press the quick control button while the menu is displayed, it will jump to the next menu group. But if you press it when the LCD is off, it will take you to a screen to control the camera. This is useful if you're working on a tripod and can't easily see the top LCD, because you can change all of the major settings from the back LCD from that quick control button along with the multi-controller. There is also now a second multi-controller that's positioned for use in portrait mode, which is very welcome. The LCD on the back of the camera is larger at 3.2 inches than the 3-inch screen on the 1D Mark IV. The 5D Mark III is also a 3.2-inch screen, but I didn't notice the increase as much on the 5D III as I did with the 1DX. It just seems bigger. Maybe because there isn't a line of buttons down the left side like there is on the 5D Mark III. Also, whereas the small rear LCD panel was directly below the main LCD monitor on the 1D Mark IV, with the image playback button to the left and the erase button, function button, and protect voice memo buttons below that. On the 1DX, we now have the playback buttons, index, magnify, reduce buttons, erase buttons, and protect voice memo buttons in a line below the LCD monitor. And the small LCD panel is now below these buttons. There's a new card image size selection button to the left of the LCD panel, but this really just replaces the function button on the 1D Mark IV. You might have noticed that this means that the magnify and reduce button is now positioned in this group and not up at the top right as people are used to. This is the same as the 5D Mark III and was difficult to get used to at first, but you can program the set button to magnify the image, and I've done that with my 5D Mark III and now the 1DX, and I find it to be a good workaround. I was really happy to hear that the 1DX was going to have two CF card slots and not one CF and one SD card slot. Although CF cards are larger, they're much faster. I used to put an SD card into my old 1 series bodies as a spillover, but this was more of an issue when I used 8GB cards. Since I now own 64GB and 128GB CF cards, there was no longer any spillover, and the SD card became totally redundant. Another nice addition to the 1DX is a gigabit Ethernet port for tethered shooting, but, and this is a big but, Canon decided that the macOS was not important enough to update the EOS utility to support wired shooting yet. You can pair the camera through with the computer. That part works fine, but EOS utility doesn't work. What's even more frustrating is that all of the documentation from Canon states that you can use EOS utility to shoot with the Ethernet connection without any restrictions. I spent the whole morning today trying to get this working, and when I eventually gave in and called Canon support, I was told that it's not supported yet. When I asked to see where that was stated publicly, I was led to a web page hidden about 5 layers down on the Japan website. You'd never find it until you run into a problem, especially when the documentation already told you that everything was going to be just fine. Oh, and I couldn't find a mention of this anywhere on the US Canon website. I figured I'd try to connect the camera with the WFT server, which is purported to have a pseudo EOS utility that works via a web browser, but with the tiny live view window and no autofocus and no automatic download of the image, it's a total waste of time. Canon, I love you guys, you know that, but stop wasting your time developing crappy applications like the WFT server on the camera, and dare I say it, DPP and image browser as well. They could go. But just concentrate on supporting the drivers and the critical utilities that your customers need to use your cameras. The Mac OS is important to the photography community. It always has been. Get your acts together. Okay, rant over. The 1DX also sports a new battery, the LP-E4N, though you can use the LPE4 that the previous 1 series bodies use. They are both 11.1 volt, but the LPE4N is 2450 milliamperes per hour compared to 2300 milliamperes per hour for the LPE4. I had heard that the performance of the camera was reduced when using the old LPE4 battery packs, but having scoured the manual, the only reference to performance is on page 360, and it says, quoting the manual here, "The use of a genuine Canon battery pack, LPE4N or LPE4, is recommended. If you use any battery other than the battery pack LPE4N or LPE4, the camera's full performance may not be attained or malfunctions may result." This suggests to me that there is no grade in performance when using the LPE4, and I've not noticed any drop in performance either during my test shooting so far. If you consider the 1DX an upgrade from the 1D Mark IV, then you basically will be gaining 2 megapixels with the jump from 16 to 18. The 1DX is now supposed to be the flagship in Canon's DSLR lineup, and it's a full-frame camera too, like the 1DS Mark III, the previous flagship model. So I have to admit that I'm slightly disappointed by what is essentially a drop in resolution. Of course, the 1D lineup is built for speed, and with a frame rate of 12 frames per second, or 14 frames per second in JPEG mode, it's easy to see where the trade-off is being made here. Even with the increase in frame rate, Canon were still able to increase the image size by 2 megapixels over the 1D Mark IV and increase the high ISO performance, so I can live with this drop. Besides, I'll be using the 5D Mark III or even the 1DS Mark III, which I've not sold yet, when I do need maximum megapixels or 2 weatherproofed bodies. I really want to maintain 2 1 series bodies for the times when I need that rugged build and weatherproofing, like when I'm sitting in a Zodiac getting drenched with sea spray in November and December this year. The autofocus on the 1DX has increased focus points over the 1D Mark IV, jumping from 45 points to 61 points with the 1DX. The new autofocus is almost the same as the 5D Mark III, which received a huge autofocus upgrade compared to the 9-point system in the 5D Mark II. Both the 1DX and the 5D Mark III are 61-point high-density reticular autofocus systems with 41 cross-type AF points, but the major difference is that the 1DX has ITR, or Intelligent Tracking and Recognition, which the 5D Mark III doesn't have. Although the 1DX uses dual Digic 5 Plus image processors to process and pump those 12 frames per second through to the CF card, it uses Digic 4 processors to power the EOS ISA, or Intelligent Subject Analysis, which is a 100,000 pixel RGB metering system. This is used to aid the AF system with automatic point selection, which improves the tracking system when using AI Servo. What this basically means is when you lock onto a subject in AI Servo mode, the camera uses color information for your subject to track it across the frame. switching to other focus points as necessary. I was hoping that this would provide a magic bullet for some of the challenging situations, but that doesn't appear to be the case in every situation that I've looked at so far, as we'll see shortly. Note that in AI servo mode, it's not obvious at first, but for you to enable the camera to use all 61 focus points to track your subject away from the manually selected focus point that you use to obtain your initial focus, you have to select the 61 point automatic selection AF. And I've included a diagram in the blog post so that you can see the difference and how these look in the viewfinder. But basically, as you toggle through or cycle through the AF modes, it's the one that says AF and then has the brackets. And when you've selected that, you'll see pretty much everything disappear except for there'll be a square in the middle of the viewfinder initially. And it's somewhat counterintuitive, but although it's called 61 point automatic selection autofocus, in AI servo mode, you still have the ability to move that focus point around, and that is used to gain your initial focus. If you conversely select single point spot AF, single point AF, or one of the AF point expansion modes, the camera will only use the points or groups of AF points selected. And that's even if you're in AI servo mode. It will not shift to other focus points if the subject moves away from the selected points or you recompose the image. So put simply, to use AI servo and have the camera track your subject around the frame, select 61 point automatic selection AF and focus with the center focus point, or move that focus point anywhere you like, and then half press the shutter button or use the back focus button to focus. And as long as you hold down the focus button, you can recompose the shot, or your subject can move as long as they stay within the 61 focus point area, and the camera will track your subject around the frame. I was always cautious of using AI servo focusing full time, as I know some people that use the back focus button do. I never found AI servo focusing to be quite as accurate as one shot, and so I shied away from using it for anything other than moving subjects, such as a bird in flight. On my second day out with the 1DX though, I went somewhere where I know that there'd be a good chance of seeing and photographing some common kingfisher. If you've ever tried to photograph a kingfisher, you'll know that they don't hang around when moving from A to B, so I decided to shoot in AI servo mode full time, although I could use the button on the lens to toggle between one shot and AI servo if necessary. I could quickly tell though that the ability of the 1DX to attain accurate focus of stationary objects with AI servo was spot on. This is probably helped by the 100,000 pixel RGB metering that we looked at earlier. The AF is no longer just relying on contrast information. It can actually see that there is a cobalt blue object amongst the green in the image that I've currently got up in the Enhanced podcast or on the blog. A few seconds after shooting this image, the kingfisher took flight, and although I lost it with the narrow field of view of the 600mm lens for a fraction of a second, I caught up with the bird as it stopped to hover just a few seconds before rocketing off again. In this next photo, you can see the hovering kingfisher, and this is something that I've never been able to capture before. Even if I see them do this for a second or so, the camera just takes too long searching for the subject. Now, I'm pretty sure I stopped focusing for a split second as I lost the kingfisher from within my finder, but despite the bird having moved towards me by a few meters, the autofocus just snapped straight back in as soon as the kingfisher came back into the frame. It was beautiful to watch from both an aesthetic perspective and a technical one, and the focus was spot on, right on the head. The bird was hovering for literally just a second or so. Then it flew away over to another perch and was once again too fast for me to catch at breakneck flight speed. But I bagged a shot that I'm pretty proud of here. And I'm actually, I put together a 4-frame animated GIF that I posted on Google+. So I'll put a link to that in the blog post if you want to take a look. I'm not going to embed it into the blog post because it'll suck up your CPU while you're trying to listen or just look at the other images. But it's over there on Google+ if you want to take a look. And it's quite impressive, if I do say so myself. And before we move on, here's just one last shot of the kingfisher. These are beautiful birds, and I'm pleased that the 1DX enabled me to get some shots that I actually like of these guys for the first time. I had a chance to take the 1DX down to the river near our apartment too, and there were a few cormorants fishing and then taking off, circling round upriver, and having been swept back down by the current, they'd take off again. This gave me a chance to check the settings that would help me to continue to track with a bird flying over water, which is always a problem because the sunlight hits the water and you get these little sparkles of light and contrast that tend to steal the autofocus from what would otherwise be a relatively easy to track subject. With a little trial and error, I was able to confirm which AF settings worked best before hunger and sunburn forced me to leave in the middle of the afternoon. I still have some experimenting to do, and of course, you'll need to change these settings based on each location that you shoot in and experience as you use the camera. But AF case 5 from the menu for erratic subjects moving quickly in any direction without any customization worked best for me with birds over water. I tried a lot of combinations, including increasing the acceleration-deceleration tracking from 0 to 1 in case 5. I tried the other cases as well, and, you know, generally the best one was case 5 with no adjustments. Even using these settings, though, if the cormorant flew over a patch of rough water with higher contrast, the focus would sometimes snap back to that, and I'd have to release the AF button on the back of the camera and ensure that the bird was in the center of the frame again, and then refocus. Once I did that, though, the camera generally stayed with the subject again, so it seems that choppy water behind birds has not magically become a non-issue, as far as my tests have shown to this point. Against a clear sky or less choppy water, though, the AI servo was relentless in tracking the bird with any and all of the 61 focus points. There's one annoying thing that was fixed with the 1D Mark IV, but is currently regressed in the 1DX, and that is that the focus point that has focus is not illuminated as the subject moves around the frame. I really liked this functionality in the 1D Mark IV, but it's gone again. The Canon Rumors website says it's something to do with the red light affecting the exposure calculation and that Canon may be working on a fix, but there are no details as of June 2012 about, you know, what's going to happen here. Okay, so let's take a look at the insane high ISO performance of the 1DX. As I said earlier, I'm not going to embed all of these images in the Enhanced podcast. You really need to go to the blog and take a look at the images there. The blog post is mbp.ac/341. And open your browser up nice and wide, because the images up that I posted are 1280 pixels wide. And if your browser's wide enough, then they won't be resized. There are also some 100% crops so that you can really see the grain or lack of it in the earlier images. So do go over to the blog to check this out. First here, though, is a range of images from ISO 800 through 204,800 in full-stop increments. I actually shot from ISO up 50 upwards, but ISOs 50 through 800 are pretty much identical, with no grain, so it really wasn't worth sharing the first four images. Click on one of the images, though. The ISO 800 is a good place to start, and then just use the arrow keys on your keyboard or use your mouse to navigate back and forth through the images and just look at the difference as the ISO increases. Each image has the ISO embedded in it, so you can see that as you go up. You can see that from these examples that if you were shooting for the web, you could go as high as ISO 51,200 without worrying very much about ISO at all. Here, though, next is a series of 100% crops of part of the main sunflower, also including the out-of-focus sunflower in the background. I included this second flower because the out-of-focus bokeh areas of images can often show more grain than the in-focus area. To view this at 100%, as I say, you'll need to open your web browser wider than 1280 pixels wide and just click on the thumbnail and then navigate backwards and forwards with your mouse or your keyboard arrow keys. If you don't open your browser window wide enough, the blog will automatically reduce the size to fit your screen. So it's not always obvious that you're not viewing full at 100%. You might recall from my 5D Mark III review that based on my tests, I made ISO 12,800 the highest ISO that I would go to without thinking about grain at all. I also set this as the ISO that my 5D Mark III would go to when using auto ISO. At a push, though, I told you that I'd go to ISO 25,600 on the 5D Mark III, with the understanding that I'd have to deal a bit with the grain. To save going back to the 5D Mark III review to check, and also so that we can do a direct comparison, I also shot the sunflowers with the 5D Mark III. So here's a series of 100% crops from the 5D Mark III from ISO 800 to 102,400. Note that the 5D Mark III has one stop less ISO than the 1DX, which is why we can't compare ISO 204,800. Okay, so after that reminder of the 5D Mark III ISO performance, let's take a look at one last set of ISO images. It's the same shots that we just looked at, but I'm going to place the ISOs from 12,800 upwards from both cameras right next to each other so that you can flick through them on screen to see a direct comparison. It seems, though, that the 1DX is comparable to one stop lower ISO on the 5D Mark III as far as grain's concerned. So I'm going to start with the 1DX ISO 12,800 image so that you'll be able to compare the 5D Mark III's 12,800 image directly to the 1DX's 25,600 ISO image, and so on. Okay, so if you're listening in your car, this is going to be pretty weird. But if you're at a computer, do go over and check these on the blog and just pause the podcast for a few moments. And after you've checked that, check these images out, come back and we'll continue. Are you back? Okay, so as you can see, the 1DX is perhaps even slightly better than one stop less ISO on the 5D Mark III up to 102,400. But I think that ISO 204,800 on the 1DX is actually quite a lot better than 102,400, the highest ISO on the 5D Mark III. Of course, this doesn't mean that the 5D Mark III ISO performance is bad. This is just the trade-off for the extra 4 megapixels, and both cameras are still amazing at high ISOs. This is a dream compared to what we had just a generation of cameras ago, and that was a revelation a few years ago too. Things are certainly moving forward quickly. These cameras can now virtually see in the dark. Based on these results, I've set the auto ISO range on my 1DX to a maximum of 25,600, which is where I'll go without worrying about grain. I would go to 51,200 at a push too, but the expanded ISOs 102,400 and especially 204,800 are probably best avoided. This is, of course, why Canon set these as expanded ISOs, which you have to enable before you can use them. With both the 5D Mark III and the 1DX, they seem to have put the limit exactly where it should be. Okay, so these are the main points that I've come across so far. I can live with the resolution for the high frame rate and high ISO performance trade-off. I was expecting a larger leap forward in the AI servo tracking performance, but I'm still very happy with the accuracy of the AI servo focusing when it locks on. For my Cormorant tests, I was working in very high contrast conditions with flowing water in the background, which has always been very tricky. Considering this, it performed okay, though I was hoping for a little more there. As I use the camera more, I'll update you in this area, hopefully with good news that it's much better in some other situations. I was incredibly happy with how it handled the Kingfisher shoot though, so there really is not anything to worry about here. It's just that I was a little bit more optimistic for the more challenging situations. All in all though, I'm happy with the camera. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Is it close? Absolutely. It's a beautiful piece of engineering, and I'm looking forward very much to taking it down to Antarctica for 6 weeks later this year. I'll be sharing my photos when I get back, of course, and that will probably be a good time to update you on the AI servo too, if I haven't done so already. If you found this blog post or podcast useful in making your decision, or indeed if you find anything that we do here helpful and you decide to buy a Canon EOS 1DX or any other camera gear from B&H Photo, please use our affiliate links on the blog. And if you decide to buy from somewhere else, good for you. You know, this is not why I do these reviews, but if you know, it doesn't cost you anything to buy with our affiliate links, and we get a little bit of help from B&H when you do. So keep that in mind if you decide to pick one up. Note too that there are still some places left on the Antarctica voyages that I'll be on with Aurora Expeditions in November, December this year, and details of that can be found at mbpworkshops.com. Also, the numbers are looking great for the Pixels to Pigment workshop seminars that I'm running in August through October this year, where we have packed weekends for you to learn color management to streamline your digital workflow and take all of the frustration out of printing too. We're starting in Tokyo and Okinawa, Japan, then over to San Francisco or LA, Vancouver, Toronto, then New York, and over to London, then to Australia, at least in Sydney, but also Melbourne and Perth too, if we can get a few more people signed up. Details of that are at pixels2pigment.com, and that's number 2 or T-O, either will take you there. And do sign up for the newsletter specifying which location you're interested in if you think you'll join us, so that we can plan for each city accordingly. Thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+ and Twitter, etc. And links to everything that I'm into are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.